Hello, thank you for joining me. This is Ernestine Lyons, host of Quick to Politic, the podcast, the social commentary show that explores topics ranging from social justice to history, economics, small business, and of course, local and national politics. Thank you for joining me. Okay, so thank you everyone for joining us in this episode of Quick to Politic. Okay, so Quick to Politic is the social commentary program and podcast where we explore contemporary issues, and we also just kind of explore the ramifications around policy. I am a former city council person who decided to run for mayor of her hometown, and since 2020 has been having deep political conversations with everybody who, you know, run the gamut from folks who are reporters in the industry to lately in June, we've been all about emerging tech, and we've been exploring the emergence of generative AI and all of the machine learning, and we've talked to so many different folks in the industry. So I want to introduce a very special guest, Nigel Sharp. And so Nigel, tell us a little bit about yourself, and we're gonna jump right into a juicy, exciting discussion.
So Ernestine, pleasure to be here and on your podcast. Excited to definitely take on some of these topics and talk to you. I think that it's very timely as we're sort of breaking into this. So I'm Nigel, CEO and co-founder of a company called Aquaga. I have been doing tech now really since I was a kid, I guess. And so like many people feel that I've got broad swath of knowledge around many, many different sort of tech-centric areas. Right now, it's interesting. I'm pretty working the least in software that I ever have in my life. Engaged primarily in sort of a hardware clean tech startup with Aquaga, where we're tackling toxic water contaminants. And yet, like, you know, these conversations around AI impact every industry and all of us across sort of the whole tech sector, both hardware, software, and beyond. And yeah, I think it's just it's a really timely conversation to sort of jump in and engage with you on.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And so I really want to just dive right into, you know, just knowing that, you know, you have this background as a serial entrepreneur and technologist. You've been involved in so many different ventures and experienced the world of startups firsthand. How do you see the role of generative AI and deep tech shaping the future of entrepreneurship and innovation? Are there any industries that will be displaced, or, you know, do we have a bright future ahead of us because we'll all be super productive and efficient?
So I think there's a lot of components to that question. Let's dissect it a little bit. First and foremost, like a bit of a base understanding of what we're talking about here when we're talking about generative AI and how that sort of impacts work in our environment. So we're very fortunate right now that we're getting a lot of exposure individually, and hopefully most people listening in here have had a chance to go out there and experience and expose themselves to some element of generative AI, be it a ChatGPT style chatbot where you can ask questions and get detailed and complex, well thought out responses using some of their newest platforms like GPT-4, etc. Along with some of the more interesting, like, you know, image generation type AI that's out there, like Midjourney, etc., that's out there creating, you know, interesting, I guess, art pieces and conceptual art and, you know, graphics that can be used in almost instantaneous time based upon a small text prompt, for example, along with many, many, many other facets of the sort of generative AI being used. So I'm going to pick on those two pieces because I think, like, just it's so hard to sort of gather all of this and then talk about it all and how it's all going to impact us, because that's, I think, what a lot of people aren't taking away so far, is they're not recognizing how broad a sense of where AI is plugging in. It's been able to, like, jump in, and be used to be able to decipher and read, you know, MRI scans all the way, you know, all the way across to be able to, like, you know, come up with the fun, quirky LinkedIn post that you're going to post out on a certain channel, to be able to, like, jump over and create really interesting conceptual art in the style of Van Gogh. Right. And so all of that, you know, is very hard to encompass in a singular conversation. But in the frame of entrepreneurship, I do think it's a very exciting time. And I'll speak from direct exposure of what I've seen just in the last year alone, of where, you know, these AI tools have been adopted. Really, when we look at it from sort of around October of 2022, I think ChatGPT definitely set some of the tone around, also some of the image generation software was out there. And the early adopters in the technology field were definitely out there really playing with stuff. And now, obviously, these technologies date back a number of years. But it's been really since last, you know, the end of 2022 that we've seen some sort of, like, you know, early adoption engagement in it. And now we're starting to see a little bit of that crossover into the mainstream. And I saw this a lot in sort of early stage entrepreneurship. So, you know, we came into this. I've been very fortunate. I've had a chance to facilitate multiple startup weekends. And startup weekends are these 54-hour experiences where people come in with an idea on a Friday night, and they work and they form a small team. They have to develop multiple facets of a sort of startup business idea to then present them on the final thing of a Sunday night. And historically, startup weekends, everything is like very low fidelity, very minimal viable product oriented. You know, if you can scratch together a few bits of paper and kind of, like, you know, demonstrate something and put together a little prototype, you're in a really good spot. You know, over the last few years, we have more rapid prototyping tools, so people sometimes could 3D print a small thing, or in some cases, like, you know, make a quick sort of mock-up design on a computer screen. But what I saw over the last year was a complete shift away from that, where I could no longer decipher presentations that were coming out of a 3-day idea from startup companies that had been forming for like a year or two. And that was a moment of real revelation for me personally in the entrepreneurial sector at its earliest stages, right? This is the very beginning inception of ideas into becoming potential enterprises, right? So this is our baby step number one in entrepreneurship. And it was exciting. Let me give you some specific examples. There was a company that was producing a pitch for a space-oriented sports club, I think is kind of like the easiest way of sort of describing it. And watching their pitch, it was amazing, because watching the slides they were produced and each thing, it looked like a really well-produced slide deck. And primarily because they had customized graphics for every slide demonstrating their point, using like elements of space and elements of like what was, you know, being displayed and discussed on the slide, and how that sort of drove into it in a fairly uniform manner. And it was just kind of breathtaking. You saw these, like, you know, beautifully designed things. And so you're like, oh wow, they must have an amazing graphic designer, somebody on the team who's been, like, you know, drawing this out. And there was, you know, a question that came to them fairly from one of the judges, which is part of the startup weekend, which is how much of this work was done prior to the weekend. And their answer was none of it. It was all done during the weekend. And there was a moment of sort of disbelief. It was like, nobody could draw that many good pictures over a weekend and put them all on slides. And they were like, no, we used AI. This is how we did it. And that wasn't just one pitch. That was more than half the pitches we saw that Sunday used AI to demonstrate and develop images for either their product concepts or for their sort of overall brand and design. And that was a fascinating shift, you know, whereas before, even if you want to get like a few logos done, you'd have to send it out to gig workers, wait 3 or 4 days, maybe get back a few variations of that logo.
Maybe now you can go Fiverr or something where you could possibly get somebody to do it in 24 hours, but then you'd still have to work with it. Whereas now Midjourney can produce, you know, all of these images, and you're getting to the point where you worry about, you know, creative students at College for Creative Studies, where, you know, we gathered during the National Peer Network, you know, we saw some of their designs, and it's just like, oh my gosh, this is going to be obsolete because now it can be generated.
And so then it becomes a question of like, well, where do those people fit in and how does that touch things up? So there's a part of me that sort of like looks at that and is like, well, that's exciting, right? Like, you know, as an early stage startup, at the earliest stages and the early stage of entrepreneurship, the ability to better communicate ideas across more succinctly and in a more rapid form and a more professional tone is beneficial. And the same thing when you want to sort of write together a pitch. I can only express in the last like 6 months of events I've been to, I can't think of almost a single event that somebody hasn't had a small prepared scripted piece they've spoken to that they haven't said, oh, by the way, we generated this with AI. And I've done it live at events now where like we're talking about something and someone's saying like, hey, I'd like to hear your response on this, and able to get AI to help me generate a response in real time as I'm just getting onto a microphone to speak, to help me accentuate certain points, because now I've got a real-time assistant that I can talk to that can help me put together a very cohesive structure of a formed response to a basically a topic to be discussed. So this is really cool, right? Like we haven't had these tools at our fingertips so easily accessible at any time in human history. And we now have that sort of plug into that. And the ability to get access to those is becoming more and more prevalent across the world as we sort of speak. And so we're sort of seeing this huge shift in like thinking about how we work. And yet, you know, you can do general polls across, you know, rooms with various industries. And I was at a water industry conference that's related to our business recently. You know, you ask and like 50% of the room had heard of ChatGPT, but only 10% of the room had actually tried ChatGPT, right? And like, therefore, like we're still in that early adoption phase. And then only a handful of people have actually adopted it and used it in their part of their regular work process. But it's like, you know, it's the working smarter, not harder kind of mentality that's going to benefit people in the short term. But I think your question had a lot more framed into it, which is that then, you know, where does this lead? Where does this go? What sort of disruption? Do we end up in a position where we're able to produce more and become more productive? Or are we in a position where we are threatening jobs and causing huge disruption to industries and like, you know, negating the benefits of somebody who has just spent a bunch of money on a college education for a few years, as you mentioned, let's use the creative arts college thing where somebody's developed, you know, a bunch of graphic design skills to now be completely negated by a computer that can do it instantaneously. Maybe not exactly at the same standard, but at a good enough standard that it can pass for what a client could do at a fraction of the cost, right? Yeah, these are real problems. Like, I mean, I think that, you know, these are real problems. And luckily, with an entrepreneurial lens, these are where the opportunities lie, right? So unfortunately, I align with a lot of the other technologists out there that I think there is a need for some increased regulation and that there is a lot of disruption ahead of us first. And in that disruption, there will be pain. But I also lie on the side of optimism that I know that in that change, there will be opportunity. And that opportunity in the short term will be taken by those who can just utilize the tools better than the others. But in the longer run, there'll be opportunity in like finding new ways of engaging new tools to help solve problems in ways we've never been able to solve them before and like change how we frame work. And I live in a more optimistic view that in the long run, these allow us to, yes, be more productive and also live in a society that is more functional to deal with the complexity around us, because we've already got to a point where there's more complexity than anybody can really handle anymore in their individual lives. And having that assistive technology to really come in and help us and support that complexity in our lives is a really exciting opportunity. So I lean on the optimistic side with a pessimistic sort of short-term view, with a sort of hopeful piece that, you know, regulators may step in to help that transition be a little bit more smooth and reasonable. And I will speak, like, I mean, somewhat on behalf of technologists that are out there, because I know that most technologists are like-minded, that nobody is going out there maliciously trying to really drive this so it causes so much devastating disruption that we end up with mass joblessness or mass homelessness or whatever else that might occur from huge disruption. Like, that isn't the intent here, but very much like the discovery of, you know, utilizing and electrifying the world, right? It causes a massive change. And this is just a moment of civilizational change that we're going through.
Oh, you know what? Thank you so much for like that insight, because I'm also glad that, you know, you are being an optimist and, you know, just kind of looking at this through a lens of a, you know, more optimistic view as opposed to being a pessimist when it comes to some of this. And I think your views are shared by Sam Altman. And I know that a lot of you know, just there are a lot of interviews with him where he talks about how, you know, this is the type of technology that is going to take the drudgery out of mundane tasks like answering emails and, you know, just kind of thinking of things and finding things and, you know, just all of this administrative work that really ties down us and it frees us up for the creativity. And he's even kind of alluded to, you know, we should be very optimistic about our future and we can even, you know, entertain thoughts of a universal basic income because, you know, people will now be free to just ideate, just be creatives. And you'll see like a new rise of creative folks, you know, because now we have taken away, you know, those more tedious tasks and we're able to, you know, just kind of really enjoy things. But this makes me want to shift into something that, you know, when we first were introduced, I feel like you presented a very terrifying scenario, whereas I'm just like, yeah, Sam Altman says it's going to be great. You know, I love ChatGPT. I use it all the time. And, you know, with the emergence of, you know, generative AI, you brought up a scenario of deep tech. And one specific thing you mentioned was, you know, its ability to just have a prompt and a assignment. And, you know, you mentioned someone said, find me the cheapest flight and it will ground flights. It will shut down airlines and it will stop at nothing to obey the commands. And that was terrifying. And so, you know, I think just as a layman who is kind of like a hobbyist technologist, you know, this is something that it was terrifying to me. And it was my first sort of real understanding of what the implications are for deep tech. So, you know, I want to delve into a question. I want to like, one, if you could tell us a little bit more about defining deep tech, what is deep tech? And, you know, what are the, you know, concerns and, you know, ethical implications about, you know, just all of this. I know Sam Altman recently had a congressional testimony along with IBM and other folks who are really utilizing a lot of this new technology.
First and foremost, I'll say that, you know, I think now it's pretty publicly known that, you know, there has been a number of open letters sent out by technology leaders across the world that have been co-signed some of the biggest names in both technology and our sort of world leaders with causes and raises of concern about the fact that, you know, we should either put a halt or slow down the progression and the speed of this because we are not necessarily able to foresee what could come about. And I think that obviously Elon Musk has become pretty famous for some of his pronouncements around this, you know, a number of years ago, but more recently that's become a more mainstream viewpoint. There's definitely some real risk here, right? And real danger, like, you know, with the ability for people to both economically get hurt as well as like even potentially physically get hurt, right? There's a real risk here. I don't like to be the bearer of like all the fear and concerns around this, but I do think there are ethical dilemmas that have to be addressed, and these aren't new. So again, I'm not an expert in artificial intelligence by any means, but I've been fortunate. I've been able to study this a little bit sort of my university years, and then I have worked enough in my prior companies and things like deep neural networks and other areas to start addressing some of these ethical concerns that exist. And They fall in multiple categories and they bear in multiple areas. But touching on a few that are really simple, just going back to the very originations of sort of AI and looking back sort of even at the science fiction modes of AI, often we're familiar with the idea of like, you know, Asimov's rules of, you know, sort of robotic beings that need to act in sort of a positive method to protect and engage with humans and take on their commands and not hurt others, right? And so we've seen those play out in various movies over the years in Hollywood, from iRobot to RoboCop, etc., as that. And we've also seen those rules kind of get programmed in artificially into even the Terminator movies, right? This has been a historic, long, well-understood challenge around AI. More recently, obviously, those conversations have been much more in-depth and broad around like self-driving cars and what happens in the case of an accident. There's a self-driving car that only has a ethical dilemma choice of either hitting a kid who's crossing the road versus hitting a pregnant lady who's crossing the road. Which one is, you know, a better choice that it has to make, you know, and how do we evaluate that? How do we score those things? Those studies that we're doing, I mean, are all fascinating. It's really interesting to see that humanly and collectively, we don't have clear answers on how we would all engage in those things. There is no clear right or wrong in many of these scenarios, right? And so therefore asking computers to be able to do that perfectly seems like an unreasonable task when we can't collectively come to those same things and we've had a lot longer to think about it. But I think that we live in a really interesting time right now where we've come from a point where before we get to full true artificial intelligence, we have things that are approaching that, right? And we have this generative AI type solutions that we're sort of stepping towards this fully unencumbered AI that I think is a concern, right? Later down the road, and we're not quite there yet. And you know, there's obviously multiple different thoughts on when we're going to hit this, you know, singularity moment where we're going to cross this threshold. But we're not quite yet there yet. But we are rushing towards it, right? Pretty full on and pretty full force. And unfortunately, like what I've seen in the tech industry, because I work in sort of startups, is I get to see tech probably, you know, 5, 6, 7 years prior to when it actually sort of starts getting over, you know, crossing over to sort of the early adoption main threshold, because startups are really that much further ahead. And I've also had a chance to work in multiple universities and institutions. And in those places, you know, technology is often like 10 years ahead of or more. It's where the science is sort of being done, of where, like, you know, the mainstream world actually gets to see and sort of experience things. And therefore, a lot of what I'm speaking about is stuff that I saw, you know, back in sort of 2012, 2011, right? So 10 years ago, I was concerned because I would work with companies back then that were working on what we would sort of call multi-agent systems, or, you know, creating little semi-intelligent agent bots to go off and sort of live on as code on the internet, seeking out specific, you know, activities to achieve those for its owner, right? In whatever way, shape, or form. And obviously, there are lots of very nasty applications of that, right? You could use it for cyber terrorism and criminality and like data mining and phishing, etc., right? And we see those things now. We see those pretty commonly. We see a lot of these bots now reaching out and phishing scams and emails and text messages. I mean, those things now exist and they are commonplace in our everyday society and life. And there's not a person behind those computers typing away those messages. Those are entirely driven by software, right? But but you know, what we haven't seen so much of, but they still exist out there, because I mean, I've seen them deployed and sent out off the internet, and they get to go off and live out there as little bits of code that get spread out into different areas. Are these bots that have these other objectives, and their objectives could be fairly nuanced and fairly minor. I mean, I like the example of like the travel bot that's just there to assist you in booking the flights and booking the booking piece. But you know, if you haven't made up your mind on exactly where you want to go, well, then maybe it can like really rapidly book a bunch of like seats in a bunch of planes and then take them off somewhere else and cause a lot of disruption really, really rapidly, to the point that these airlines couldn't be able to keep up with just this constant like booking and unbooking request. And our protections against that are pretty limited, right? They've got all these cybersecurity protections that really don't exist against these semi-autonomous bots that can go out there and you know, navigate the human internet, as it were, and the human internet experience. And I think that's where we're seeing some of the challenges. And so then I drive this all back to like, what is the definition of deep tech? Well, to me, at least in the context of what we're speaking about here, deep tech is exactly these areas where we start seeing semblances of real intelligent technologies going out there and advanced systems. And so where we're seeing deep tech is often where science has crossed over. So where we're seeing things at the front end coming out of research institutions like universities, etc., crossing over into the startup entrepreneurial world, where there's commercial value in creating a technology that has some meaningful impact for the world. And that's often where I sort of see deep tech lying in, right? It's not the fullest definition of it by any means. Again, the type of company I work on, working on toxic water contaminant destruction, is also a deep technology company with a university patented intellectual property being spun out. But for the context of today's conversation, I think a lot of deep tech is, again, that advanced sort of computer science being used to generate tools and self-generated tools that can then create new challenges and new problems down the line, right? And new opportunities, right? Again, going back to that optimistic frame that with this, Whenever there's been a counterbalance, which has happened many times in the history of the internet, for example, wherever we've seen an overshoot of like things that are going to become a security risk, we've seen an increase and an opportunity for a bunch of new cybersecurity companies to pop up. And like, you know, where those who developed the viruses, et cetera, there's antivirus solutions that come up, right? So there is a world of counterbalancing that goes on, right? I like to sort of look at it from a more sort of like, you know, Zen philosophy of the yin and yang in constant balance. The hard part right now is that just AGI and the generative work around AI is just wrapping so rapidly that we haven't quite found that counterbalance just quite yet.
All right, so folks, you heard it here first. Deep tech does not equal when Skynet goes global. So, well, you know, when we're talking about ethics here, you know, as you know, someone who you know just had this has had this passion for advocacy and working in local politics and state level politics here in Michigan, what are some policies that you know just lawmakers and you know at whatever levels, whether it's state or federal, you know, what can policymakers really do to ensure responsible development and deployment of you know just these emerging technologies and you know just the ethical implications there? I mean, I know that there that during the congressional testimony where you know some of these tech companies you know were there to testify, there was the idea of a suggested oversight committee that could, you know, just really regulate, you know, the use of artificial intelligence.
So I think the short answer to your question is honestly, I don't know. I don't think I'm either qualified or necessarily the right person to ask on what the best policies are. But I can definitely talk a little bit about we should be very mindful of what the consequences are of the potential policies that could take place, both good and bad. And I think one story that's really fascinating to watch right now is where we're seeing Europe and the UK play out on their different approaches and stances on AI regulation, with Europe being very clear that they are going to regulate and regulate pretty hard, and the UK taking a softer approach on that. And then these US businesses saying, well, we're going to make, you know, entrance and investments into the countries that have lower regulation, or at least taking a lower, you know, a more easy regulation stance, because we want to get those footprints into those locations. But we don't want to move into places where we think it's going to be highly regulated, because we know it's going to be bad for the innovation, the opportunity that we can get in. And those companies are making those distinct market, you know, in investments because, and I mean, I can give you a couple of examples. I think the ones in the news this week were Salesforce, you know, going into the UK and making a $3 billion investment, which is more they've made in the last 5 or 10 years, whatever it was, in just a year, because they want to be early in a market utilizing AI very heavily in, you know, in their platform for, you know, obviously their sales platform. And I mean, I think there's other examples like that. And then, you know, government's been able to tout and like do that. Simultaneously, you're seeing the public or PR departments of these same companies saying, no, we absolutely want to comply with upcoming regulations and doing that. But sometimes you have to follow and see where the money actually goes. So what are the consequences of the policies? Well, the policies are going to be interesting because some places are going to win out over others, right? And therefore, you know, will these policies get made at state and local levels, or will they have to get made at federal level, is like still a bit unclear with this. But I think that it's going to have to be very intentional. And unfortunately, it doesn't like there's not I don't think there's universal policies that will work for everywhere. And hence why usually, you know, you have policies that roll down and roll up into different, you know, within these like complex regulatory, you know, environments that we have. And that's something that's going to be a challenge, because I think there's going to be some places that are going to be able to create more favorable environments and less favorable environments for those who want to like leverage and utilize, you know, tools. And this is broadly how I think we have to talk about these AGI tools, is that they're tools, and they're providing us, you know, arguably one of the most powerful tool sets that we've ever been able to sort of add in since sort of like, you know, the Industrial Revolution. And therefore, we've seen the effects of that previous times in civilization history, where entire mega economies have been built upon, you know, the freedom to utilize the latest and greatest tool to empower itself and drive its economy forward. And yet, you know, there's the very real risk that, like, you know, by running so far ahead with a set of tools, you could, because of the nature of the tools that we're talking about, you know, could easily disrupt your entire, let's say, state economy and create a bunch of joblessness and other problems and, like, you know, things that have all these other, you know, societal impacts, that then you'll be spending all your time trying to fix all of those that you won't have any time to, you know, to hear the benefits of. And this is, you know, again, really fascinating. So I think what will happen is that those who are more conservative, which is generally, I think, true for a lot of the regulator types, are going to take sort of the conservative approach. But some places are going to be slightly more proactive with leadership that want to align towards a future vision of the world. And other places are like, no, no, we want to see what happens and wait and see what happens. So therefore, there are real consequences when the policies that are going to come about. And I think those consequences will play out globally because this is software and because it exists on the internet. These consequences are going to play out, you know, really globally. And access, once again, will become a big issue. Those who have access to the tools versus those who don't are obviously going to have big disadvantages or advantages. And so countries that are putting blanket bans on these tools up front right now are in a position that potentially have put themselves in a weak position. But they're taking a moment of protection, right? They're looking at it from a security point of view right now. Security to maintain society, which arguably is a very prudent thing to do, because until you understand something, the best thing to do is maybe pause before you rush into it. And I think that's what broad global community is sort of saying, is that the need for having oversight committees that can sort of speak to this is a little bit of the deproliferation work that needs to happen. And the hard part with the deproliferation challenge right now is that until something really bad happens, there's usually very little reason for anyone to actually sort of take a pause. And we're sitting at this very interesting point that we are playing, you know, playing with fire and then waiting to see who gets burned first before anyone takes a pause. And people recognize entire economies could collapse before that, you know, happens. And it's really interesting, right? So historically, obviously, we've had a few of these cases, you know, as a civilization. I mean, I think, you know, without making it too doom and gloom, but, like, you know, nuclear deproliferation is obviously a big topic, you know, and if you look back in the sort of 60s and 70s, kids grew up at that time, right, where the Cold War was very active, and there was a real concern that everybody was ramping up their nuclear arsenals that could destroy the world at any time. And there was a real and intentional method that the global community came together, said, like, no, this is not acceptable. We need to find a way to ramp this down and get it under some sort of, like, control and mechanized control. This is different, though, right? Like, this is a little bit different. We aren't dealing with, like, a bunch of people that need to figure out how to enrich uranium and put them into warheads and put them into silos and bunkers and rockets into fire, you know, places. This is software and this is code and this is thing that exists in data centers and in any country with any sort of internet connection around the world. And that changes the context a little bit. Obviously, it favors those who have the biggest access to those kind of resources. So it kind of favors companies like the Microsofts of the world who can develop this stuff, and less so for the smaller economies and countries that don't have as many of these pieces. But arguably, it's a more democratized kind of, you know, threatening weapon that can be used, right, if you want to think of it in that context. And therefore, I think the only way to look at it is that probably what needs to happen is it needs to be some sort of deproliferation effort made globally. But nobody wants to take that first step because, much like, you know, nuclear arsenals, nobody wants to back down if they think somebody else is going to get further ahead. And right now, we're still at beginning stages of everybody wants to get the tool set because nobody wants to be in those. I mean, if we look at the modern day politics and societies, there's countries that have nuclear weapons and there's countries that don't. And the ones that do generally are on the side of being more powerful in the world than the ones that don't, right? They're broadly speaking, macro politics and coming at it from a technologist viewpoint. I mean, I have no real authority in that space, but that's broadly how I sort of see the world laying out. Well, I think that's the same situation with AGI right now, as we sort of move towards a sort of general intelligence, at least, that we are going to get to a point where everybody wants to be able to have that. And then there'll be a need like, well, how much can you use that and where can that be controlled and throttled, I think is what's going to happen, you know, post that. So that was a long answer to say. I don't know how to answer your question on what policies should be put in place, Ernestine, but at least, you know, a bit of a talk about the consequences which you consider and maybe a need for, you know, a longer term policy on deproliferation of technologies that can be dangerous. And we've done this in other cases as well, including, you know, biotech, for example, with cloning technologies, etc. And this is the same kind of situation where we definitely have taken attitudes around bioweapons and biotechnologies. And so at the moment, you know, AI isn't being discussed as a weaponized technology, but it is definitely being developed as such by many people. So
Well, you know what? You actually made me think of another question about, you know, countries of the global South and, you know, the possibility of being left behind. And I know I've been personally exploring, you know, just the digital divide that, you know, just folks who, even in the United States, there's already a technology divide and there are some folks who are left behind. But we're just about at time. And so I do want to just delve into, you know, one last question and get your closing thoughts. And I do want to thank you for, you know, taking this time. And I know we're in different time zones, but, you know, I just really wanted to chat with you about all of this. And I know that, you know, organizations like yours, you know, kind of have this social impact and there's a mission oriented. And then there are lots of, you know, corporate social responsibility movements that are happening. And, you know, I think that people want to use new and emerging technology for good. And, you know, you definitely see that happening. But, you know, I just wonder sometimes if when you look at generational differences as a millennial myself, you know, it's, you know, the internet has almost always been a part of my life, you know, from me being tween age onwards. And then you look at Generation Z, they're never known a time without the internet. And do you think that there are long-term implications of over-reliance on tech? And, you know, just what can we do to, you know, just kind of encourage creative thinking, encourage independent thought, and, you know, just kind of disconnecting, because there's lots of statistics that show that, you know, folks who feel disconnected when they're always on devices and things and in engaging with, you know, machines, that there's, you know, more disconnection with friends and family, and, you know, they're feeling depressed and there's more anxiety and there's more to do because now you have more tools to work with and to be more productive. And so you never really stop to take a walk in the woods. So just your closing thoughts on, you know, over-reliance on tech.
Wow, that's a lot to pick at that. I'm going to keep it pretty short and say my broad answer to all of that is yes and, right? Like, yes, and it's all, yeah. That is the fun of being in the technology space, is that these are fundamentally tools that are being developed. They allow us as human beings to shape and create the world that we want to create. The hard part is who's driving those decisions around what type of world we want to create and what type of world do we want to shape. In the end, you know, corporations and companies can create AI policies internally that protect their workers and their workforces from having both maintaining their jobs and allowing them to be more productive. Or you can have boards and executive boards deciding their companies are going to, you know, utilize AI as heavily as they can to reduce, you know, the overall operational expenses their companies have and minimize their workforce to automate more things, right? These aren't new discussions. We've had this with robotics in the past and other things that are going on. And so this also happens across the whole of society. You know, as technologists take a step forward, there's an ethical choice that all technologies have to make around what are we developing and how are we doing that? So when asking that question, you know, my call always goes out to the fellow technologists out there in calling on them to make sure that they're choosing every day when they wake up to use their magic powers of creating these great tools to make sure that they're thinking about, like, who is it benefiting and how is it benefiting society as a whole, and not just their own personal bank pocket or whatever else it might be, because we have a duty to everyone in society and we have to, like, look after and maintain our broad, you know, community, nation, and, like, broad global community. So I think there's a little bit of that. And simultaneously, as a technologist, you know, I've often joked about, like, well, there's a part of me that would love to go off and be a Buddhist monk and live on the side of a mountain with nothing and disconnect. Great. But I'd really like to take my laptop with me anyway, though, because, like, you know, I you know, and that's the hard part. That's the, you know, the one asset that, you know, whatever it is, the laptop, the phone, is the one thing I don't want to give up. And I think if you look at a lot of people now, we derive huge value from having these things with us and engage with us. And we're moving very rapidly into a world where disconnection will become less and less less and less possible. We will have access to internet through satellites, etc., anywhere on the face of the earth, right? And maybe the only place you're going to disconnect from the internet would be if you're in the deep oceans, for example, or up in space somewhere. So, you know, it's going to get very interesting to sort of see where this goes forward. But simultaneously, as an entrepreneur, right, taking off my technologist hat, which sort of sees a proliferation, this is happening anyway. It ain't stopping now. We're already going to get to the point where we're going to be consistently connected. With my entrepreneurial hat, I look at people as, oh, these are where the opportunities exist, right? There will be opportunities to offer experience and curated, you know, travel experiences to people that want to get off the grid, and off the grid experiences will become a increasing industry as people want to be able to disconnect, you know, go down, you know, into these environments that don't have internet access, etc., and beyond, right? Like, so many more opportunities will come from points where people want to learn to utilize these tools in other ways, and so new businesses can form around that, and like transforming experiences and lives as we start expanding, you know, AI and mixing it into like virtual reality and other things. And now you're sort of having like the opportunity to interact with virtual computers and interactions as companions for people that are elderly, to like kids as their teachers. I mean, like the world is, you know, rapidly changing, and you're going to have all these different interactions that are there. And in that, there's all this opportunity for entrepreneurs to step in and utilize that. But ideally, those businesses will get formed. And I increasingly have hopes that they'll get formed with social and environmental impact missions associated at the very core and the foundation of components of their businesses, so that we're aligning those goals correctly, so that, you know, you aren't sitting there with somebody bringing up a board decision like, well, you know, the best thing for our shareholders would be if we use this thing for this purpose, which would otherwise be considered pretty nefarious on a otherwise purpose. So yeah, I think that is the future. And if entrepreneurs and technical entrepreneurs and technologists out there, don't forget that we're all humans, and we can all share and cultivate a better future for us all. We're in a good space to do that.
All right. So it sounds like being able to disconnect in the future is going to be a luxury, sort of almost like a travel destination sort of thing that you have that rare moment where you can just unplug. And so, well, thank you so much for being a part of the Quick to Politic podcast. And thank you for all of you out there listening. And Nigel, where can we find more information about you? And, you know, just all of the, can we follow you on socials, or where can we find all of the information?
It's pretty simple. I mean, I think Twitter is a good place to find me. At Nigel Sharp on Twitter is it works well. I'm also on LinkedIn for those folks who want to follow sort of the journey of a entrepreneur who's now working on a hardware clean tech, you know, solving a big environmental challenge for the world. So happy to engage with folks on LinkedIn as well. But I'm on the socials. I am connected and plugged in, and don't disconnect too much from those things. Although very much recognize that it is important for us to sometimes turn away from those screens and look out there, because there's more to the world than just what's in front of us here. But I don't want people to turn off until they've at least finished listening to the whole podcast. So thanks, Ernestine.
Right. Exactly. Remember to like, comment, and subscribe if you're viewing the playback. But if you're listening out there, remember you can stream the Quick to Politic podcast, all places where streaming happens. All right. Well, thank you so much. And that has been our program.
Well.